Welcome again to New Books in Islamic Studies. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each program, we choose a new and exciting book in the study of Islam, and we chat with the author. For today's program, I had the pleasure of speaking with John Renard about his great new book, Islamic Theological Themes, A Primary Source Reader, which was published with University of California Press in 2014. Islamic theology is generally understood or approached in terms of its systematic or speculative forms. In this new book, Islamic Theological Themes, John Renard has produced a collection of primary sources that thinks through theological deliberation far beyond the narrow strictures of Kalam. This inclusive model is both chronologically expansive and geographically diverse. Renard offers relevant passages from the Quran and Hadith, the Tafsir tradition, narrative histories, manuals of moral direction, texts for spiritual guidance, creedal statements, and political theology. All of these sources are artfully introduced, leading the reader through the diversity of the Islamic tradition. In our conversation, we discuss human responsibility, the nature of God, the evaluation of non-Muslim beliefs, what merits community membership, the spiritual journey, functions of poems, stories, and letters, Iblis, mercy and justice, political succession, governance, and questions of leadership, and the social consequences of theological thinking. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with John Renard. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Today, I have the great pleasure of speaking with John Renard about his great new book, Islamic Theological Themes, A Primary Source Reader. Welcome, Jack. How are you?
Thanks, Christian. Very nice to have a chance to chat with you like this. And looking forward to talking about this book. The term labor of love is tossed around a lot, but this one really knocked the wind out of my sails toward the end. Just trying to get it finished, I was really under a lot of pressure on it because it's a complicated book, and it involves getting permission and paying for that permission, and then kind of putting the book together in such a way that it's balanced and thematic, and that there is a pedagogical dynamic to it. So if I ran into something that wasn't going to work out or that I was going to have to pay a fortune for, I had to get rid of that and put something else in its place, and that might have caused me to have to juggle a few things and so forth. So it was right toward the end, the last year of it, it was a major stressor.
Well, we appreciate your hard work because it really is an excellent book, and I think you achieved all those goals. It's very well organized, well thought out, and it's a good read. The translations are very nice. So, before we get into some of that, though, as is tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies, we hope to learn a little bit more about you. So, if you don't mind, could you tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the study of Islam? Perhaps people that were influential in your approach, or that got you interested in the topic?
Sure. Well, this goes back over 45 years, actually, back to the late 60s when I was teaching high school. And I was a Jesuit at the time, and I was teaching at a Jesuit high school, and they wanted me to teach Latin and Greek, which I had majored in as an undergraduate. And so I did some of that, and then they wanted me to teach religion, because I was sort of halfway through a master's degree in Bible studies at the time. So they asked me to teach world religions to juniors. It was kind of the standard fare for high school juniors in Jesuit schools at the time. So I got into that, and I enjoyed it. And this was in the late 60s, 69, 70, and it was prior to the so-called Arab oil embargo. But even then, even before the time when people were getting really annoyed that they were taking our oil and things like that, there was still a feeling that I got when I talked to people about different religious traditions and so forth, that you could mention Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and people kind of found it exotic and interesting, and there really wasn't much at stake in the topic for them. But mention Islam, and sort of the emotional temperature in the conversation would sort of go up. And so I got more and more intrigued about it because, and I felt, I basically felt bad about it because I, from what I knew at that point, it was a very powerful, rich tradition. And I found a lot of beautiful material in it, just, you know, from a very, very superficial level. And I decided that I was just finishing my master's. I finished up teaching and went back to finish the other half of my MA in biblical studies. And I asked my Jesuit superior if I could go over to Israel and kind of kill two birds with one stone, take an 11-week course in intensive Arabic at the Hebrew University, and then go to biblical sites on a weekend and kind of, you know, catch up and sort of round off the MA program for myself. And so they allowed me to do that. And I took this Arabic course that I had already tried to start beginning to learn Arabic just on my own. And I had got the alphabet down, but that was about it. And I had these two really wonderful teachers, one an Israeli woman and the other a Palestinian woman. And they were wonderful teachers. So that was a great experience. And then I had a chance to really knock around the country a little bit. And I met a lot of wonderful Palestinians and just was really delighted at the kind of what I sensed was the sociability and the hospitality of the culture and so forth. And I figured I needed to do something like that before I decided on a PhD program, because I thought, you know, if I don't like Arabic, I'm not enough of a masochist to put myself through an Islamic studies program. So I figured I'd better try it out. And I loved it. So I came back and I had my third year of theology still to do. This was in 72, the summer of 72. And I came back and I still had my third year of theology before I was going to be ordained. So I figured, you know, I wasn't going to get any Arabic done during that year. So whatever happened after that, I would probably do well to start over again. So I applied to a number of schools in Islamic studies, and most of them were sort of the Near Eastern languages and culture departments. And I got into a number of really fine places, and I decided to go to Harvard because the other places were in cities that I really wasn't interested in living in for 5 years. So I thought, you know, Boston's a great place. So I went there, and I wound up taking first year Arabic, and I was 28 years old, and I was sitting in a room with Harvard freshmen, 18-year-old kids, and they used to call me Gramps because it was delightful. I mean, there were a number of people. Well, Marilyn Booth, who's kind of a famous Arabic translator, she's over at the University of Edinburgh now. She was a college freshman then. Ali Hassani, who's at Harvard now, he was a college freshman. So I was across the hall from her, sitting next to these delightful young folks, and I realized that it would be a whole lot easier if I had started this at the age of 18 than at the age of 28. So that was how I got into it. And I basically decided that when I went to Harvard to start this program, I thought, well, I'm gonna do Arabic for sure. And then I thought that since I'd done a bunch of biblical Hebrew, maybe I could do medieval Hebrew as my second language. And I found out from various people that, you know, that's not probably the thing you want to do. You ought to talk to Wheeler Thaxton about Persian. So I did. And Wheeler became one of my favorite teachers up there. And then there was a choice of, you had to do two languages for your comps, prepare for that, and then two other subjects. And when I went there, I was hoping I could work on theology with Wilford Cantwell Smith, whom I had heard of, and a man named George McDizzy. And the day I got there, I went over to the department secretary and I said, how can I get in touch with Professor Cantwell Smith and Professor McDizzy? And she said, well, you'll have to either go to Philadelphia or to Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, because they both just left. And I was a little bit disturbed about that because I figured I was going to have to make my way. And two people whom I had not heard of turned out to be my main professors there, one, Anne-Marie Schimmel, and Oleg Grabar, who was really a wonderful historian of Islamic art. And I thought, I'd, okay, I'm going to make Sufism and Islamic art and architecture my my third and fourth areas. So after a couple of courses with Anna Marie Schimmel, she was very solicitous with graduate students and very interested. And I was working on my comps, and I decided I'd better come up with a topic for a dissertation. And so I went and talked to her, and I said, I had this list of topics. And I said, what do you think about this? And she'd say, no, don't do that. That person's too recent. Oh, don't do that. There are some relatives who will object. Oh, don't do that. There's too much secondary literature. And then I said, well, how about Rumi's prophetology? She said, do that. There's almost nothing written on it, and it's a great topic. So that's how that happened. And as a result, I wound up working on two major subjects that I had no idea I would work on when I got there. It was kind of the luck of the draw, and it turned out to be a very lucky draw.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's really interesting to hear this background, too, kind of reflecting through my imagined copies of your books in my head and thinking about the range that you cover in most of your books and this one as well. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this particular project began to emerge as a book. You've written a ton. So when did you start thinking we need to have this reader?
I started thinking about that in the early 90s. And I had kind of put together a rough outline of something that would be an anthology, but defining theology very broadly so that it wouldn't be mostly or even predominantly or even certainly not all and not even predominantly hardcore systematic theology, the Kalam variety, because I had, as a Jesuit, I had 3 years of a traditional MDiv program in theology, and I really appreciated the sense that theology isn't just this kind of dry, systematic discipline. It suffuses cultures and literatures, and so I was tinkering with a way of coming up with this kind of an organic overview that would, of course, take account of the systematic, the sort of rational theology, that kind of thing, but would also include, for example, the theological aspects and themes of the scriptures, and in this case also the Hadith, and kind of the broader cultural resonances of these theological themes. So I applied for an NEH summer stipend in the summer of 94. And I was at the time I was calling this thing Muslims on God's Mind, which I thought was kind of cute. But it turned out to be cute, too cute by half, actually. And so I never did wind up using that topic, that title. But that was a good summer because it allowed me to kind of hammer out a general outline of it. And then I guess it was about around that time that I gave a presentation in an AAR session that I called Kalam Chowder, which is also too cute by half. But everybody got the joke, and or almost everybody. And so, you know, it was a kind of a combination of things percolating in the early 90s and then kind of and getting to that summer NEH summer stipend when I was actually contemplating a two-volume thing, a monograph that would be one of these organic looks at the whole theological spectrum, and then an anthology to match it. Well, it turned out that what I had thought would be a monograph had turned out, well, about 15 years later in this book, Islam and Christianity, to be sort of a hybrid of that. And then what I had originally wanted to be Muslims on God's Mind turned out to be much more descriptive Islamic theological themes. So basically this book had been percolating for about 20 years by the time I finally got it done.
Yeah, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. So listeners, I'm sure, know how prolific you are. And if you don't mind just talking about kind of your method for a moment, you have a history of producing really wonderful complementary volumes. And you mentioned this one, Islamic Christianity, as almost not a direct complement, but related to this reader. Could you talk a little bit about your approach to projects like this? And perhaps why do you think this model works well? Why do you continue to kind of create these projects?
Well, that's interesting. I guess I've always kind of liked the idea of broad spectrum projects. I've only done a couple of things that were more narrow, like, well, basically my dissertation got published by SUNY, that all the King's Falcons on Rumi's prophetology. But just about everything else I've done has been a broader kind of thing, and I just have always kind of enjoyed that. In some ways, I've worried when I get into them, is this going to be impossibly big? and I've found myself saying, yeah, this is impossibly big. Why did you do this to yourself? But so that basically, there's been a lot of stuff left on the cutting room floor in the process to make them more tight and cohesive. But it's all about, really, for me, trying to define, like, for example, in the Seven Doors to Islam and the Windows and Aisles of Islam, which was a pretty close match of companion anthology. I was trying to again do this kind of broad spectrum of things that give insights into this kind of amorphous phenomenon that I labeled Islamic spirituality. But again, beginning with the primary sources, the scriptural sources, and then moving into more systematic things like pedagogy and mystical treatises and things like that, so that I could sort of wrap it all together in a way that I could develop in sort of a progressive fashion, you know, going from the less technical to things that would involve people in learning a little bit more of the theory of Sufism as the theorists themselves have articulated it. And then the most fun project I've ever done of all these was the Friends of God pair, Friends of God and Tales of God's Friends. I really hated to see that end off, although I was ready for them both to end. But I really, that was just more fun than anything that I've ever done. And I'm hoping that the next one I'm going to work on will be as much fun as that, but we'll see. I'll tell you about that later.
Yeah.
But so those are why I thought, well, you know, I looked around and I hadn't really intended to move into the area of hagiography, but what has happened generally to make me decide on these different projects is that I look around and I discover that there's nothing available in these certain areas. For example, and there are specific studies of individual Friends of God, specific studies on regions, Friends of God in South Asia or Friends of God in Turkey, but I could not find, this is back in the early millennium, I couldn't find a single thing that gave a really decent overview of this whole huge phenomenon of Islamic hagiography. That was what got me interested in trying to do that. And then kind of working through the material, I thought, well, there's a kind of a good structure that I could work out that would work on the lives of the Friends of God and sort of patterns in their lives or themes. And then looking at how that would be in the story. So the first part is really about the function and themes in the stories. And then what that material tells you about how the Friends of God across this broad spectrum have engaged their various communities. And then I put these two more theoretical chapters at the end on theological themes and literary themes. And it all just kind of unfolded as I was doing it. When I talked to the University of California press editor, religious studies editor at the time, Reed Malcolm, I said, I really want to do this as a two-volume thing, Are you willing to do it? And he had been assistant to the previous religious studies editor back in the early 90s when I did the Doors and Windows. And he said, yeah, he said, let's talk about that. So we worked it out that whatever I was doing on the monograph, I could kind of be parallel working it, doing the kind of planning the anthology with that companion role in mind. So that's kind of how that worked out. Mm. Is this making some...
This is great. Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think you've been very successful in this with this model, and I think others would be wise to follow it. So it's good to hear some of the ways that you go about doing your wonderful work. So thank you.
Thank you.
So in all those previous volumes and in this volume as well, you highlight both the geographic diversity and a wide range of chronological sources. Can you talk a little bit about the selection sources? You mentioned some of the kind of practical constraints, but as far as when you're constructing a reader like this, what are you looking for? What kind of diversity do you hope to get? And as someone who studies China, I would be interested to hear. You're one of the few people who always includes China, which I very much appreciate. So how do you go about thinking about your sources?
Well, I look for interesting topics and things that would be big topics. You know, the themes of revelation, prophecy. So I don't want to go too far afield. This book could wind up six volumes if I don't kind of trim this down. So I started off by trying to decide on certain kinds of themes, and that would be arguably central to the theological enterprise, whether it takes the form of looking at the scriptural text in the Hadith and seeing what those main themes is. Basically, kind of, I thought, you know, what would a phenomenologist of religion do looking at the Quran? So I picked out a couple of things that I thought would be interesting, you know, the kind of the classic phenomenological categories, transcendence, immanence, and that sort of thing. And then I just basically followed up looking at, in the chapter on interpreting the sources, looking for good examples of major characters who had reflected on and done little or sometimes larger exegetical expansions on these particular kinds of texts. So that's basically what I did in chapter two, is I focused on the verse of light and the throne verse. So right away the material is limited. So I try to make it pedagogically flow each chapter from its preceding chapter, and then got a little bit into the hermeneutics, you know, so there are questions about, again, the basic, kind of classic things, occasions of revelation, rational interpretation of scripture, the causes of abrogation, how the Quran is a miracle, you know, the inimitable, ijaz, and all those kinds of things. So I figured that would be enough. And so that's the basic material in the first two chapters. And then I thought, you know, before I got into the hardcore kalam kind of stuff, I thought there's another whole body of literature that deals with kind of the cultural aspects of how Muslims have defined community in relation to the world around them, and then internally as well. So that was kind of the material for chapters 3 and 4 on Muslim awareness of other religious communities, and then the large categories of creed and polemic. And I thought, you know, there are some really good texts that include for Montgomery Watt and a few other things like that, that have large selections of creed in them, but you have to buy the whole book to get a good selection. So that was when I got in touch with people at Edinburgh, and tried to find out whether they'd give me a decent deal on a couple of those creeds, and they did. So there you go. There's the creedal material in chapter four. And I tried basically to give a sample of there's a Hanbali, there's a Ghazali Ash'ari creed, there's a Maturidi creed, there's a Shi'i / Mu'tazili creed, and then there's a modern creed, Sayyid Ahmad Khan. So then I got into the hardcore stuff, and this, I was hoping that by the, after people had read the material in the first four chapters, this kind of highly technical material, whose questions can be a little bit daunting, would seem a little more easy to grasp, and started off with doxography, you know, Shah Rastani's rundown on the different Muslim schools, which gives you a sense of the diversity of theological methods and perspectives within the community. And then got into the sort of methodological overviews of Kalam, and again, was looking for a way of defining it fairly sparingly. You know, one would be an Asharite perspective, another would be a Mu'tazili perspective. And then getting into some theological themes like prophetic revelation, prophetic miracle. And then I wanted to put in an Ismaili perspective as well. So I got some Tusi's Ismaili views on post-prophetic authority. So that was a text that I liked because it was not only kind of a broadening of the community perspective, but also moving beyond prophetic authority and, you know, what happens then. And then some themes, God revealing, experiencing God hereafter. So that was kind of the general concern that I had with that. And then parts four and five, that got into one of the things that I was most comfortable with, and that is spirituality and literature. And there again, I tried to find examples of texts by really major people, Rumi, Sana'i, Attar, Muhammad Iqbal, and themes that would follow up on the themes that we've been talking about in earlier chapters. And then part five, got into serious issues of ethics and governance. Ethics and Theory, chapter 9, so it was kind of on, beginning with Hassan al-Basri's letter on moral responsibility, which I just think is a really an amazing piece. And Valerie Hoffman I found out that she had translated that whole letter and she had not published it. So that's one of those good examples of the serendipitous nature of how I managed to come across people who had done things or who were in the process of doing things. So, you know, the whole process was a combination of careful planning and then happenstance that just moved in the right direction.
So, Jack, how do you envision readers using this perhaps in complement with what you do in the Islam and Christianity monograph that you produced?
That's a good question, because I'm planning to try and do that for the first time next fall.
Good luck.
it's going to be interesting. And what I've done in the past, I've taught a course called Islam and the Christian Theologian, I guess four times now, beginning back in the days when I had the Islam and Christianity volume just in the form of PDFs, which I provided to the actually the one before that one, I still had it in draft, and I asked, it was a group of honor students. We had 12 really bright honors kids in this little seminar, and one of their jobs was to help me edit the thing and rewrite things that need to be rewritten, and they really got into it. But after that, then I started pairing that text with Irfan Omar's two edited volumes, one of Tom Michel's essays, Christian's View of Islam, and then Mahmoud Ayoub. He has a volume, but Irfan Omar put Marquette edited called A Muslim's View of Christianity. So they're basically collections of essays. And I found those very useful. And basically what I did was just, I tried to pair the material from those books with the chapters of the Islam and Christianity book thematically. And so what I'm going to do this next fall, I think I'll probably keep those two because next fall it's going to be a 500/400 course, which means that it will be for majors and MA students. So I'll ask the MA students to do a couple of extra books, but I'm probably just going to try and do a thematic pairing as close as I can with the primary source text. So this will be really the first time that I've done that class with a heavy dose of primary source material. And I know that this material, it will take a lot of pre-lecting, as they say. Now, next week, we're going to talk about this, and here's what to look for. And so I'm looking forward to it, but I must say, I'm a little apprehensive about how getting into some of this heavy-duty primary source material is going to work. So I think I'll just have to, as I say, be very careful about laying the thematic groundwork out ahead of time.
There's a few sections that I wonder if you could kind of elaborate on for us. In one of the chapters on spirituality and literature, you talk about poems and stories and letters, and these are mediums and forms that many would probably not think of in theological ways, that this is theological literature. So what do you say, how can we understand the theological function of this type of communicating the underpinnings of spiritual direction?
Oh, well, let me just start with, for example, Sana'i's Enclosed Garden of Supreme Reality, Hadithat al-Haqiqah. That struck me as so perfect for this because he gets right in and riffs poetically on the very kinds of things that the masters of Kalam had been doing for hundreds of years by his time, talking about God's attributes, the meaning of divine unity, the problem of anthropomorphisms. So that was a no-brainer in a sense, because that was really talking about the very things that the theologians who called themselves theologians were talking about. And the same with the Ibn Abbad letter on relating to God's attributes and names. I call that pastoral theology in that section, because what Ibn Abbad was doing there is, again, he's working as a popularizer of the very same themes that Sana'i was treating as a poet, and that the theologian had been working on, well, since the 9th century. So what I was looking for in these literary examples of theology, doing theology literarily, so to speak, was reflections of those main themes that had been talked about in the earlier chapters, and giving a little space to the different ways of expressing those very same themes. That is not technical. That's not. It's not strictly rational in terms of it's being a kind of ABC progress. But you get somebody, for example, like Rumi, in one of his discourses, in this case translated by Wheeler Thaxton. I called it Rumi on the Many Languages of God Talk, because Rumi does what Rumi does everywhere, and that's he gets into almost sort of a stream of consciousness sometimes, and he kind of segues from one interesting topic to another, and then a little bit later he'll come back to where he began. So it's almost, he does theology almost the way a narrative poet does a frame tale. Did I ever tell you the story about so-and-so? And, oh, that reminds me of the story of so-and-so, which reminds me of this other story. And, oh, let me finish that last one before I go on to the second one and then back to the first one. So he begins three themes, and then finishes the third theme, and then finishes the second theme, and then finishes the first one. That's something that he does in the Masnavi quite a bit. So it struck me that this is a really a good example of reflection in a non-technical way. So he gets at these themes. What do people mean when they talk about God? And here again, just like the material from Sana'i and Ibn Abbad, and then also Ibn Tufail in that next section on narrative approaches to major theological themes, he's reflecting in a non-technical way on the very things that are the substance of the theological debate in the more explicitly theological discipline that generally gets known by the name Kalam. Hmm. So, and then there's a theme that I knew I had to get in there somewhere in the book, and I didn't have a place for it yet, and that was the Muhammad's spiritual finality. And Najmuddin Dayarazi's book, the Path of God's Servants, Irshad al-Ibad, that is really a beautiful, highly metaphorical, really it's a poetic reflection only in prose on how Muhammad was the perfect loaf baked in the oven of divine revelation. You know, so you get this whole ambience of metaphor, and that's one of the things I really like about that. And I knew I couldn't leave that out because it's so much a part of the literary legacy and the mystical, the Sufi mystical legacy, but it's all of a piece with the work that the theologians and the philosophical theologians had been doing for centuries.
Now, in the final section, you focus on ethics, both in theory and practice. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the ways that ethical discussions got put into action. So, for example, what would be the social consequences of theological thinking, according to these authors that you included?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think I would start with the issue that I brought up first in that question on ethics and theory, and that's this. I think it's the underlying theme, and at least in my minimal experience of dealing with Islamic ethics as a specific topic, but the underlying question goes right back to the issues that I brought up in the chapters on reading the sacred sources and interpreting them, the question of divine freedom and human responsibility. And so basically, the ethics in theory, as I saw it here, is a variety of discussions from different perspectives, Bakilani, Bazdawi's Maturidi perspective, the Ikhwan al-Safa, and beginning with Hassan al-Basri. These are all different perspectives on what it actually means for a person who believes in God and in God's perfect agency to still take responsibility. I think about this proverb that I heard years ago, and it basically comes down to anyone who denies that God is omnipotent is an unbeliever. Anyone who denies that he sins is a liar. So basically, it's this kind of you're stuck either way. It's like God telling Iblis to jump into the water but don't get wet. It's that kind of dilemma that runs through this ethical discourse. How do I, as a human being who's trying to struggle with how to live a good life, deal with my own responsibility and still believe that God is pulling all the strings, so to speak? So that was one I had in mind there, and when I chose these different readings, and I think in that collection there, that chapter 9 on theory, the translation of Bazdawi's Maturidi perspective is a really good example of close reasoning if I ever saw it, because I wanted to get a text from Maturidi himself, And I looked at his Kitab al-Tawheed, and he's got sections in there on istita'a, you know, the moral capacity, the capability. And a friend of mine over in Birmingham, University of Birmingham, David Thomas, had translated some of Maturidi. And so I asked him if he thought it would be possible for him to have a look at this text, and I sent it to him, and would he be willing to contemplate translating it? And he worked on it, and he came back and he said, this is devilishly difficult. And the earlier pieces that he had translated of Maturidi's were equally difficult, but he kind of bulldozed his way through them. But he said, I found this text by Basdawi, who is a Maturidi, and it's on the same theme. It's a lot clearer, and the Arabic's much clearer than Maturidi's. And so that's how that wound up in there. And I find it difficult to get through because it is so precise and so nuanced. But so that's kind of at one end of the spectrum of ethical theory. Boy, this is really cutting right to the bone, philosophically and systematically speaking. But then the other ones, and also the Abdul Jabbar Mu'tazili review, that's pretty, they're getting back into serious systematic thinking there. But the chapter on ethics and practice then gets into a little more experiential view of both personally and societally what this dilemma of God being all-powerful and human beings being responsible nonetheless for their choices. So that's kind of what I thought I was hoping that would be two chapters that would balance each other off, first being pretty difficult kind of reasoning in some cases, and the second chapter being more experientially based. So not so much on the level of the views of the imamate and so forth, but when you get into personal and social ethical guidance, you hear a man like Ibn Hazm reflecting on anxiety and self-knowledge. And it's really amazing. For Ibn Hazm, I also wanted to get him in there. So this is another one of these, getting back to this question of why I chose certain things. I thought, I got to have Ibn Hazm in here somewhere. And I remembered his text on anxiety. And so I thought, you know, this is interesting, because this is a guy who has a reputation for being a real hard nose. And here he is just kind of letting his hair down and very self-critical. And then Ghazali talking about this contentment with divine destiny, talking in a pastoral mode that Ghazali is, I think, probably as good at as anybody in the tradition, and talking about how it is possible to be at peace with this ethical dilemma. Divine destiny, yep, you have to deal with that somehow, but you have to be content that you are going to make your choices and you'll have to deal with the consequences. But divine destiny includes a large measure of mercy and, let's say, ethical leeway, so to speak.
Now, the final chapter focuses on ideas about political succession and governance. For those that perhaps are not familiar with the tradition as well, why would we have a discussion about leadership in a theological conversation?
I suppose to put it in non-technical terms, it's all about the two principal schools of thought about the nature of succession to the prophet as an authority over the community. And, you know, that most people have heard, everybody knows the difference or the what they perceive to be the enmity between Sunnis and Shiis. I mean, anybody who listens to the news now about Yemen is hearing that one of the big military forces in play now against Al-Qaeda are the Shiite Houthis, and against the Sunni Al-Qaeda. But, you know, that's kind of like asking people if they understood what was going on in the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Yeah, the Catholics and the Protestants, they hate each other.
Hmm.
So this is really a little bit, it's an attempt to put something a little more specific, make something a little more specific available to a reader about exactly how these differences of opinion hinged on the notion of authority, and how authority devolves from God through the prophet and on through the history of the community. And that's why I thought that would need to be in there. It is technical, but it's at the beginning of practically all of the treatises of theology of pretty much every school. Ashery's got his one at the beginning. Maturidi's got his at the beginning. In other words, the notion of the imamate and the debates on it are absolutely essential in all the more hardcore sort of systematic theological traditions.
Well, you've produced another excellent volume, and we appreciate all your hard work. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on now, which are probably equally as exciting.
Sure. Well, right at the moment, I'm working on a revised edition, 50% revised edition of Historical Dictionary of Sufism, which came out 10 years ago. And that's basically a little one-volume toolbox basically is everything I always wanted to know about Sufism and do long enough to type it out. That's kind of my definition of that book. And so I'm kind of closing in on the end of that. And what's coming up next is a monograph that is, at least for the moment, titled Crossing Religious Boundaries, Exemplary Lives in Jewish, Christian, and Islamic Traditions. And I'd started tinkering with this some years ago, kind of as a follow-on to the Friends of God and Tales of God Friends combination. And I was looking for a way to use these paradigmatic personalities, exemplary lives. At first, I was going to do it just Christian and Islamic. And then I thought, well, it wouldn't add that much to the book in terms of size if I included an acknowledgement of the major characters in the Jewish tradition. But basically, I'm looking to use the phenomenon of exemplary lives as a way of bridging, showing how these figures can bridge the gaps between and among these traditions. So it's a three-part thing. And the first part is called Hagiographies Compared, Retelling the Tales of Religious Exemplars. And that's basically a look at the narrative themes and their theological implications, and then a look at the theological themes more specifically, looking at how the literature weaves in to the narratives, theologically and religiously rooted devices that are designed to communicate tradition-specific concerns. And then third chapter in that part is how stories open doors across traditions, and that looks at not the function of the theological themes, but now the function of narrative in these stories. So you get into things like the social function, constructions of gender, institutional pedagogy, political functions, aggrandizing individual figures, dueling institutions, you know, these narratives of how my shrine is more powerful than your shrine, things like that. And then the part two is get into the specific characters. It's called Meeting the Exemplars. And I divided it into three different kinds of thematic areas. One being historical dimensions, looking at some it's a typology of some of these major characters, progenitor type, reformer activist type, cross-cultural witness, missionary warrior, those kinds of types, and then theological or devotional dimensions. And again, it's looking at a typology of characters, people who are fonts of wisdom, knowledge, and sanctity, the contemplative, the conduit of divine presence and power, like the healer, the wonder worker. And then a chapter on exemplarity and the way it is communicated along with religious authority. So that would be part two. And then part three is the section that I'm really looking forward to the most, because it's all new for me, and it's where the learning curve gets really steep. And it's called Geographies Shared, Religious Crossroads in the Greater Mediterranean. And the purpose of this section is to look at how in three geographical areas, Spain and North Africa, the Central Middle East, and then Anatolia and the Balkans, how in those three areas there is a crossover in the personalities of certain exemplary figures whose meanings, who have sort of hybrid meanings, you might say. In other words, a character who would be of interest and even of devotional connection with more than one of the two, more than one of the three traditions. So in Jewish and Christian and Islamic, or Jewish and Islamic shrines in Spain and North Africa, in the Central Middle East, Christian and Islamic, or sometimes also Jewish, and then Anatolia and the Balkans, again, a Christian and Muslim. So you get characters like Khidr and St. George, who are major kind of crossover characters. What I'm going to try and do is look at some more of these figures, many of whom I've never encountered yet, I hope, and I hope I will encounter, as examples of kind of the personal dimension of how these religious communities have actually crossed over historically. And I'm using examples mostly from late antiquity and early medieval times.
Wow, that sounds like a great project, and we definitely look forward to that. Thanks again, Jack, for your time, and thanks again for producing another one of your wonderful volumes, and I hope listeners will pick it up.
Well, thanks very much, Christian. It's delightful to talk to you, and it's fun to get back thinking about this. The book pretty much was done a year ago, or a little less than a year ago, and now I'm kind of, I've nursed my bruises from it enough to want to go back and read it again.
Well, good luck with your course. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. That was my conversation with John Renard about his great new book, Islamic Theological Themes, a Primary Source Reader, published with University of California Press in 2014.